This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, January 15th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll check in with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner will speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, CAI's Sam Houghton, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and we'll hear from CAI's Mike Dean at the State House and Eve Zuckoff. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. The rollout of the coronavirus vaccine continues across the Cape and islands. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us with this story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve. Great to be here.
Jeanette, we're now marking a month since local healthcare workers received the first doses of the vaccine. This week, we saw first responders getting it and some older veterans. You were on hand as first responders from the Upper Cape got theirs on Monday. Tell us a little bit about that scene.
Right. So this was at the Human Services Building in Sandwich, and it served hundreds of people over a few days. They were from the four Upper Cape towns, so Bourne, Falmouth, Mashpee, and Sandwich. And it also did the fire department from Joint Base Cape Cod. Folks would pull up, they'd be in their vehicle at first, give their names, and then park their cars, and they actually did go indoors inside the building. They had three vaccine stations inside, but they were really only using two of them because the appointments were spaced apart in such a way that it just wasn't that busy. And to reduce exposure, virus exposure, they created sort of a one-way movement system inside, with one door in, one door out. And they were actually running ahead of schedule by the middle of the day on Monday.
Right now, there's so much pressure for the vaccine to roll out faster than it has so far. And many people want to know when they'll have their opportunity to get it, where they might be able to get it. What can you tell us about plans locally?
Barnstable County is looking at five potential vaccination sites. The health director, Sean O'Brien, says it's likely that two of those sites will be the big testing sites, which are, of course, the Melody Tent and the Cape Cod Fairgrounds, but that hasn't been finalized yet. He's not really ready to announce that. Exactly who gets the vaccine when is really being set by the state, with a few exceptions, like the VA clinic. But next week, they're starting in what are called congregate settings. So that's group homes, jails, things like that. And then, again, according to the state schedule, phase two starts in February, which brings it out to people who have two or more underlying conditions and people 75 and older. And then it goes down through a priority list throughout phase two.
How about people who are here as second homeowners? We've seen, at least anecdotally, an uptick in the number of people who've stayed on since summer and or who have landed here kind of as an escape from somewhere else.
Right, right. Senator Julian Sear is calling this group the Stranded Snowbirds. And he says the local plan is yes. Unless the state stops them, the county and the task force-sponsored sites will be giving the vaccine to those folks, even if their legal residence is somewhere else.
I know you heard a little this week about what the Cape's hospitals, how they're dealing with this. Tell us what you know about that.
Yes, there have been times when the Cape hospitals had no patients in intensive care with COVID-19, but that's not at all the case now that we're in this surge. Vera Harik of the County Human Services Office tracks the COVID data, and she says that as of Wednesday night, the two Cape hospitals had 56 COVID-19 cases, of which 14 were in the ICU. And she says many, if not all, of those ICU patients were on ventilators. So they're really quite seriously ill.
Hmm. Jeanette, also this week, you looked into contact tracing as it's happening in our area. We heard a lot about this early on in the pandemic, and it's still seen as an important public health tool. But the surge in cases has made it really challenging. Explain for us how towns are doing this now.
Well, it depends on the town. So they can hire their own public health nurse to do contact tracing, but most of the towns on the Cape, 12 of them, have been paying the Visiting Nurse Association to do at least some of their contact tracing. Especially the higher population towns are also sending cases to the state, which is another option they have, and that is free. So in Yarmouth, for example, the health director there, Bruce Murphy, told me they switched to the state because the cost of paying for it themselves was just too high. So then the state, in turn, has contracted with a nonprofit group called Partners in Health to make the actual phone call. Partners in Health tells me they're now doing 70% of the tracing in Massachusetts. So certainly many communities are taking advantage of this opportunity. For them, for Partners in Health, the second surge was really a lot for them to handle. They said things ramped up so quickly. They've hired 2,000 people, but there actually was a period in November for about 2 or 3 weeks when some patients, about a quarter of patients, didn't get a call. And so that does kind of fit with what we had been hearing from a few people in the community who didn't get called. But now Partners in Health says they're reaching 90% of the patients.
One of the things that they're doing is not only asking people where they, you know, might have come into contact with this, but advising people on how to isolate and how to quarantine safely.
Right. So, and a lot of people do have those questions because they may not have had that one-on-one call with the place where they got the testing or with their own doctor. So the contact tracer is a good source for that. And then, of course, they want to know anyone you may have been in contact with since you were infected, because that's another important element of contact tracing, is to kind of try to stop that chain of transmission in its tracks by getting everyone you may have contacted into isolation.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. First responders on Martha's Vineyard are having their moment to get the vaccine beginning today. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times has that story. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
George, it's nice to have you on. Last week, we talked about the recognition that not everyone actually wants to get the vaccine, even among first responders. Your reporters checked in with local departments. What did you hear?
Yeah, so, you know, we had talked a little bit last week about how Chilmark, there was some pushback from some of the police and firefighters there. So we wanted to find out, well, how did the rest of the island towns feel? And out of about 275 people who are eligible to get this first dose, the island chiefs told us that 250 have signed up. So obviously, there are a few people almost in every department across the island who are opting out of this. And we don't know exactly the reason why, but, you know, we can hypothesize that there are people who, you know, just feel like it was maybe rushed a little bit and are concerned about that. One of the chiefs, Bruce McNamee, who we talked to, he's the Edgartown police chief. He thinks that he could get even more people in his department to sign on after they see some other members of the department get the vaccine and no ill effects from it. So this number could rise, you know, as time goes on. But for now, you know, there's a good percentage of police and firefighters and emergency responders on the island who are getting the vaccine. But of course, there are a few who are skeptical.
Today is the first day of this rollout. Is that right for the island?
That's right. Happening right now at Martha's Vineyard Hospital. We should have an update later today as well, with some photos of some of the people who are getting their shots today. There'll be a clinic today, tomorrow, and Sunday for first responders only. You know, that's one of the frustrations of people. There are people out there who say, give it to me now. If the first responders aren't going to take it, we'll jump in. But they are doing this in a very rolled out fashion, trying to get to people who are COVID facing people, as we've come to hear over and over again, first, so that they can be protected in doing their jobs.
Let me ask you about another story you've got in the paper this week. The island has its own chapter of the NAACP. It goes back almost 60 years. You have a nice look at some of its early history, including an especially active contingent known as the Vineyard Five. Tell us about them.
That's right. This is a great story by Jeff Currier, and look back. And I have to say, we're very fortunate to have the Martha's Vineyard Museum which chronicles so much of this stuff. And, you know, we get to jump in and report it to our readers, which is fantastic. So in this particular story, the way the NAACP originated on the island was there was a pastor there who went to North Carolina, and he ended up getting jailed for his part in trying to be a civil rights advocate. And so this Vineyard Five, these five women hearing about this, decided that they needed to take some action and that things needed to change. So on the island, they formed the NAACP. Incidentally, it was started on the exact day that JFK was assassinated, and we all know that he was a big civil rights advocate. Really an incredible story because, you know, the island has always, particularly Oak Bluffs, has been a place where African Americans have felt like they could go and, you know, get some respite from the racial inequality that they face. And so not surprising that there's been an NAACP chapter on the island for that long, to be sure, given the island's welcoming of African-American people.
That is George Brennan speaking to us from the Martha's Vineyard Times this morning. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good weekend.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Chatham continues its efforts to promote housing that's affordable to young and working families. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle has the story and joins us now. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, issues of affordable housing are familiar to every town across the Cape and Islands. Chatham is considering something new here. Tell us what's happening.
Sure. Well, as you said, this affordable and attainable housing is an issue throughout the Cape. It's especially difficult in Chatham, where the median sale price of homes has jumped to $725,000. They calculate that a family of four has to make around $160,000 to afford that, and that's almost 200% of the area median income. And that puts these homes, most of the homes here, out of reach of most people, especially young families. Chatham has been trying to crack this problem for some time, and this week the Board of Selectmen discussed ways to raise revenue to try to put its Affordable Housing Trust Fund in a position to be able to purchase or build affordable housing. Selectman Jeffrey Dykins raised the idea of a 0.5% mansion tax. Basically, this would be levied on property sales of $2 million or more. And he said he calculated that this past year that would have raised about $564,000. This would be what's called a real estate transfer tax, which would require approval to implement not only by town meeting but by the state legislature. He said it's a reasonable request from people who can afford it, people who are driving the average housing prices up by paying a lot of money for homes that just a few years ago would have been more or less attainable. Board members,
let me jump in here, Tim. So they're asking for, he's suggesting a 0.5% tax on properties, on the transfer of the real estate of properties over $2 million. What kind of response did the rest of the board have to this?
Sure. The board kind of agreed that they think the idea has merit and they want to discuss it further. A couple board members, particularly Dean Nicastro, said he wasn't enthusiastic about imposing a new tax, especially a targeted tax like this. But the board members seem to think that it would be worth looking at special legislation to see if they could actually do this and get it through, and whether there'd be support in the community for it. Now, they're looking at also a couple other measures to try to raise money for affordable housing, including using the Community Preservation Fund, which already allows funding for affordable housing, but expanding that to also include what they're calling attainable housing, sort of mid-range housing for working people. That also would require special legislation. And the selectmen actually authorized their town council to work on language to do that related to the CPA. Chatham gets over $1 million a year in CPA funding, and they think that some of that money could be used not only for affordable housing, but for sort of the next tier up to try to purchase and support attainable housing for people in the workforce here.
This has been such a long discussion already. Do people feel like these solutions that are being proposed have some chance of making an impact?
You know, I think they're trying a little bit of everything to see what sticks. And they are really, I think, frustrated because they haven't been able to make much of an impact. The town has an affordable housing trust fund, which has it has quite a bit of money in it, I think over $1 million, but all they've managed to do is support some Habitat for Humanity housing and purchase one house in the last several years. So I think selectmen and townspeople, too, are frustrated that there really hasn't been much more progress in this. And we're seeing the outfall with, you know, as we've talked about before, the decrease in student enrollment at Chatham Elementary School. People see that as a symptom of the fact that there aren't a lot of young families being able to stay in town, chiefly because of the housing prices.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
20th Century Fox is coming to Provincetown with some big stars. Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner has this one for us. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Marianne, this is where you and I, we get to be a little like Entertainment Tonight. A television crew and everything that goes along with it will be shooting in Provincetown for a little more than a month. Tell us what we know about it.
Well, it's funny. There's a lot of hype, but at the same time, there's a lot of mystery about it. So what we can say is that on Monday, the Provincetown Select Board gave the town manager the green light to approve what's called a location agreement with 20th Century Fox. And it's for a project called, just in quotes, Pilgrim. So there aren't really a whole lot of specifics about what Pilgrim is attached to, although there's quite a bit of social media talk about how it's possibly going to be the 10th season of American Horror Story. But in any case, they are the studio is planning to be in Provincetown pretty much the entire month of February. And if you look at the location agreement, they're pretty much, it's very intensively in Provincetown, where they're saying they're going to be filming on, you know, all of Commercial Street, Bradford Street, the town's most historic cemetery, and, you know, many other places. So they're going to be pretty much everywhere, I think.
And this is a big undertaking. They're talking about a cast and crew of about 100 people moving through the town to shoot in all these different locations.
Well, that's right. Although at the same time, in November, the show Hightown was also filming, although that was really across the Cape. So there were some segments in Provincetown that they had about 200 people. So in some sense, it feels a little smaller, but the filming is all in Provincetown, as far as we can tell. Some, I think, in Truro and in the National Seashore. So it is more concentrated. And, you know, I was just looking at the Instagram following, and for American Horror Show, it's like 2 million followers versus about 11,000 followers for Hightown. So it's definitely has the potential to attract what might be a lot of onlookers who are going to want to check all the, you know, the filming out. That's probably one of the biggest concerns of the select board at this point.
And the reason they believe it's American Horror Story is that the showrunner, Ryan Murphy, owns a house in Provincetown, and he's been on social media suggesting that he's bringing the show to Provincetown, and it's got a cast. There's people like Kathy Bates and Macaulay Culkin and really some bigger names that I guess the selectmen have some concerns that it could draw people to try to view this spectacle, and in a time of the coronavirus, that, you know, drawing crowds is an issue.
I think that's definitely true. It's big, kind of big names, although, you know, it hasn't quite been linked officially to American Horror Story. But I know the select board at their meeting, one of the select board members, you know, was talking about how it's very likely to draw a much bigger crowd. And the interim town manager, who he has, you know, like 30 years experience of town administration, kind of worked to reassure the select board that a planning would be in place to handle crowds, and that, that, you know, when companies are in town filming, that there's really, you know, kind of regular communication throughout each day that they're there with town staff. The one thing that was sort of in common with Hightown from November and this one is that they hire, for the staff and for the cast and crew, they hire, you know, like a health coordinator person who makes sure that at least for the cast and crew that they're tested like every 3 days for COVID. Everybody has to wear a mask, you know, unless you're actually being filmed. So there are a lot of standards with the cast and crew at this point.
It's Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Nantucket continues to see its share of coronavirus cases even as the vaccine rolls out. And the island also has a website form for people eligible to receive the vaccine in the next phase of the rollout. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror is on the line now with those stories and more. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, it's been a little bit since we spoke. Catch us up on the COVID news on the island.
Sure. As in a lot of communities, there was some surges, first that tied to Thanksgiving and then more recently to Christmas and New Year's. The island's numbers did trend upward for almost a month, but that most recent surge is on the wane. Nantucket Cottage Hospital President and CEO Gary Shaw told the select board Wednesday night, six new coronavirus cases were reported on Tuesday and seven on Wednesday from the testing that's done at Nantucket Cottage Hospital's asymptomatic and symptomatic testing sites, and 226 negative results came back from those 2 days. Over the past 7 days, ending on Wednesday, 95 COVID-19 cases were reported. That's a 10.6% positivity rate, which is down from an almost 15% positivity rate. It was fluctuating between 13 and 15% for a good chunk of the last couple of weeks. In the week leading up to Wednesday, there were 27 cases last Thursday, 36 last Friday, and then 12 on Tuesday. So the numbers are trending down. You know, equally positive and more positive note, perhaps, is that no coronavirus-positive patients were hospitalized on Nantucket yesterday, and none have been transferred off-island for a higher level of care in over a week. 17 patients have been transferred to mainland hospitals since the start of the pandemic for more care. And as you mentioned, the vaccines are being rolled out. They've already been administered to Nantucket police officers, firefighters, and residents of the town's only nursing home, while residents of other congregate living communities can start expecting to see their vaccines around January 25th, town officials said. And the second phase rollout is expected to begin early next month, and there is a website which you can access from our website, act.net, that you can register if you believe you are eligible in the second phase. That gives a list of those people who are eligible to get signed up, and then you'll get an email back or a call back from the town telling you when and how you can get your vaccine. Since the start of the pandemic, 742 of those who have tested positive, just over 1,000, 1,009 as of yesterday, have recovered. 263 are in isolation at home, and there have been four deaths. The most recent was on December 22nd, Nantucket man in his mid-80s.
Josh, I want to ask you briefly about another story you've got this week. It's a proposal on the next town meeting warrant to take a portion of the land bank money and use it for affordable housing. Explain what this means.
Sure. And town meeting has been pushed back from April to June because of the pandemic, so there's going to be plenty of time to discuss and debate this issue. But what this means, Brooke Moore, who's a member of the town's Affordable Housing Trust Fund, which is sort of the umbrella town organization that has received appropriated money from town meeting and other sources and uses it for affordable housing initiatives, has proposed that a quarter of the land bank fees that get paid through a surcharge on real estate transactions on the island, and that added up to almost $40 million last year alone and about $20 million a year in recent years, be used instead of going all to the land bank, but a quarter of that money goes to the trust fund for affordable housing initiatives. No one really is debating the fact that affordable housing and open space acquisition are important hot-button issues on the island and are of paramount importance to the island. But the debate comes down to funding. It really is a question of whether money that's earmarked by state law and has been for decades for open space should be put toward affordable housing. Land bank proponents say that while $37 million and $20 million a year is a lot of money, it's necessary for the land bank to maintain its operating expenses, to do maintenance of the properties it has, and to buy new and additional properties, waterfront properties, contiguous open space properties that, given Nantucket's housing market, are quite costly. And they say they really can't fulfill their mission if a quarter of their funding is siphoned off. They suggest that the trust fund go to town meeting on an annual basis or find another method to raise the money. They did receive about $25 million in appropriations last year for affordable housing projects, and they haven't spent very much of that money yet, although they do say a couple deals are in the works.
It's Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The state may be getting a new state seal. CAI's Sam Houghton joins us now to explain why that's making some advocates happy. Hiya, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Sam, many people may not even be aware of what the Massachusetts state seal looks like. It appears on the flag, right? What's been the issue here?
Yeah, well, there's a few things, you know, advocates are pointing to that's wrong with the seal. And these are folks trying to bring more awareness and, you know, equal rights for Native Americans. For one, the seal depicts a sword in kind of a striking position. Underneath the sword is a Native American, so it could be construed that the sword is kind of coming down on the head of the Indian. And then there's the motto with the seal, which in Latin basically says, by the sword we seek peace, but peace only under liberty. So some obvious implications there. And tribes around the state say this evokes imagery, you know, promoting a history of conquest and genocide. What I thought was also kind of interesting, I spoke to one Mashpee tribe member who said that, you know, that imagery of the Indian or the Native American doesn't even look like someone from a local tribe. It kind of has the characteristics of, you know, a Native American more out west. So obviously, you know, a lot of implications with this current seal in the Native American community.
So Governor Baker has signed legislation to create a commission to examine this and propose something new. Native tribes are going to be included in this?
Yeah. So the idea is behind this is create a 13-member commission. Almost half the group will be represented by Native Americans. The wording of this kind of resolution that the Baker signed is basically five members will be appointed who descend from tribes with a historic presence in Massachusetts. There will also be members appointed by the governor and other cultural groups in the state. It's not exactly clear when the commission will come together, but they have until October to come up with this new design. And I guess important to note here that it might not be completely new. They might take some of the elements of the current seal, but they might just, you know, scrap it completely. But either way, you know, tribal members I spoke with say, you know, this is a big step forward. They've been calling for this for something, you know, three decades or more. And they're hopeful this will lead to a more, you know, inclusive that will kind of better represent local tribes. And also, you know, I just wanted to throw in there, the town of Mashpee is also undergoing a seal change. The town seal is basically a replica of the state's, not exactly the same, but pretty close. The town has formed a commission with members of the Mashpee tribe and town leaders. So I, you know, I think it'll be, you know, exciting to see what comes from both of these new commissions.
Also this week, Sam, you reported on how the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe is responding to the pandemic, specifically the vaccine rollout. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so the Mashpee tribe, they've gotten two shipments so far from the federal government, each with 100 doses, so about 200 in total. They are prioritizing health officials, essential workers like police officers and tribal elders. So, you know, pretty similar to how the state is rolling out their vaccine. And I talked with Brian Whedon about this. He's a member of the tribe's lead council. He says there has been some hesitation from some tribe members. We've seen similar reports of this, you know, across the country, really. There's kind of a general skepticism of the healthcare industry in general. But Whedon says they are encouraging everyone to get the vaccine. He actually took it recently. And he actually got a little flack from the community. He's kind of on the younger side. He said even his own family didn't necessarily agree with his decision there, but he said the idea is, you know, to lead by example. He's actually been advised by federal officials to actually do this. So he posted a video of himself online getting the shot, and he's hoping that it'll encourage others to get the vaccine in the tribe as well. But the tribe, they say they'll get enough doses for everyone that wants one, and eventually they'll have enough for even spouses of tribal members.
That is CAI Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from my home office. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Coronavirus case numbers are not the only thing that's spiking on Martha's Vineyard right now. Numbers for domestic violence are also up significantly, as they are nationally, too. Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette joins us to talk about this. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, this is a strong story. It's also a hard one to get at. Tell us what your reporter, Maya Coleman, found when she looked at this.
Yes, so we looked at a mix of Edgartown District Court records and records from the Gazette's public record of cases heard at the court, which are generally similar, but sometimes a little different. And we saw that there had been a striking spike in domestic assault and battery charges since the pandemic began, with, you know, pretty much 63% of all assault and battery charges were classified as domestic. I think there were 90 in total, so that left approximately 60 in the last 9 months of 2020. And that represented a pretty significant increase from 2019, when I believe there were only 45 only, but there were 45 assault and battery charges that were heard during that entire year. And then it goes, you know, assault and battery, those are physical domestic acts of domestic violence, but it also, court records also showed that the court granted 236 abuse prevention orders last year. Many of those were issued under total emergency circumstances while the court was closed to the public. So that meant that those people were going out of their way to make it to the court when in reality, the court was essentially closed down during, you know, pretty much pandemic lockdown. And 8% of those were violated. And the police, you know, they also, even outside the courts, they saw an increase in domestic violence calls, and police are often the first responders to those. I think Edgartown Chief Bruce McAmey said he saw a 42% increase in domestic disturbance calls over that period last year, or over the same period last year. And since then, the trends pretty much held steady. Edgartown responded to 30 more domestic-related calls and 12 more domestic assault and battery calls in 2020. There were more restraining orders that were issued and more specific domestic violence-related charges like strangulation. Those also increased. So, yeah, it was, you know, it was troubling to go back and look at those numbers. And I think it's obvious sort of from a national trend standpoint. This is something people might have heard about. But it is frightening to hear about it in your community, too. Your local,
well, tell us,
you know, especially on an island.
Tell us a little bit about how people who are facing this can access support and help in the island community right now with the pandemic happening.
Well, one of the factors that I think was sort of troubling about this was that support systems on the island, which are robust and have remained robust since the pandemic began, actually saw a decrease in calls during the same time that court records were showing an increase in acts of domestic violence occurring. And there are a number of factors for that. And since the early days in the pandemic, those numbers have sort of flattened and that support services are seeing similar call volume numbers. But there are multiple different avenues that people can reach out to. And there's a hotline that's available 24/7. Community Services, which has the Connect to End Domestic Violence Center, offers services for hundreds of people on the island, as does something called the Safe Harbor Food Pantry, and that works generally with Wampanoag women or other victims of domestic abuse. They don't have to be women. But, you know, interestingly also, I think, is that just in the court system, the levers of justice have slowed since the pandemic began. We're not getting dispositions very often. So that means that people who are getting charged with domestic violence charges are often not getting disposed. They're being let out of jail. And in some instances, that can cause just a much more difficult situation for people who are issuing or trying to get abuse prevention orders and that kind of thing.
At the end of your article, I just want to point people to that you have some of the phone numbers and website resources for people who may be facing any kind of domestic violence right now.
Yeah, the number for Connect to End Violence is 508-696-7233. And the Safe Harbor number is 508-955-9164. And those are available at any time. It's a 24-hour hotline. And there are people here to help, and the support systems are strong.
That is Noah Asimow of the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Governor Baker had some deadlines this week for bills the state legislature sent him at the end of the last legislative session, which ended last week. Meanwhile, a new legislative session has started, and so far it's shaping up to be another unusual year. CAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean for the latest. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
Mike, it must have been quite a day at the State House last week when the House and Senate were sworn in for the 192nd legislative session. That was a week ago Wednesday, and that was the day of the insurrection in Washington, D.C. We've now got a new House Speaker on Beacon Hill, plus some freshman lawmakers. Do you have a sense of how this session will shape up?
Not really, tell you the truth. You know, to be completely honest with you, no one has any idea what the session's going to look like. Right now, it's going to look a lot like the 2020 session, which was, you know, completely unique because of this pandemic and all of the different stresses that the pandemic is causing lawmaking. You're right that it was a very different day last Wednesday when they brought in the new class, mostly because of the lack of pop-in circumstance. You know, the Senate did their swearing-in outdoors. The House kind of had swearing-in ceremonies for the new members, but all the returning members did it remotely at home, so there were significantly fewer people in the building at all during that morning. And then, of course, as the afternoon turned into what it did in D.C., people's attention was kind of drawn there. And it really must have been kind of a shock for these new members to be in a Capitol building as it is, under lockdown, it's still not open to the public, and then see all these images from D.C. Of what was going on in the national Capitol. So if that's any indication of what the session is going to be like, it's going to be anybody's guess. Of course, we have a brand new Speaker of the House, Ron Mariano from Quincy. He's now returning, technically, because he got elected at the end of last session. But Republican leadership is the same. In the Senate, Karen Spilka is still in charge. Her leadership team and committee chairs haven't really changed all that much. Doesn't look like she's going to make too many shifts. But all eyes really are on Mariano, who has to build this new leadership team. Does he keep people from the old DeLeo regime? Of course, he was a part of that, so he has, you know, that's a pretty solid team. And he's got supporters he needs to promote into these kinds of powerful chairmanships. If somebody was on board early on, that's the kind of person you reward with these plum positions now. So we're still looking at what those committee assignments are going to look like. And all of this is happening at the same time as they're starting to mull over the 2022 fiscal year budget plan, which is going to be starting up, you know, in the next couple weeks.
Meanwhile, looking at the governor's workload this week, in addition to announcements with various COVID-19 related initiatives and news stories there, he also had a lot of bills that were put on his desk at the end of the last legislative session. The bills range from the climate change bill, which you and I have talked about, all the way down to some smaller local bills.
Yeah, exactly. And this is what happens when Democrats pass these bills at the absolute last minute. It gives the governor enormous power to reject or alter or just outright kill a lot of this important legislation. Now that we're in the new session, however, those bills can be kind of reincarnated and passed again with plenty of time to get it over the finish line if everyone is still on board. And there is this climate bill that would really set the state's emissions at 2050, zero net emissions, meaning that the state doesn't produce nearly as much greenhouse gas as it does now. But there is conflict between the legislature and the Baker administration over how actually to get to that net zero emissions. Baker doesn't reject the premise. He just doesn't like exactly how Democrats have plotted out how to get there. He thinks that adding too much green energy too fast could lead to spikes in prices. Green energy right now is far more expensive than traditional dirty power. That's still a conflict that, even removed from this particular bill, we're going to see some strife between Republicans and Democrats really all the way up to 2050 as climate change is increasingly an issue that lawmakers and the executive branch deal with.
So there was, as you said, some tension and strife with this bill, and now the governor has vetoed it. Earlier this week, House Speaker Ron Mariano said that if that happened, he would just refile the bill. So is that what we can expect next?
Yeah, this is a big power play from Mariano and with Spilka as well. But it is unique and bold, honestly, to see a Speaker of the House coming out and saying, Governor, if you reject this bill, we will simply refile it and then override your veto if you do it again. So we're seeing that from Mariano, kind of a big, bold move to start off his speakership and to start off this session. And it's kind of a signal from Democrats to Baker saying, you know, don't play games with this. We passed the bill. We want it. We have the votes. Just sign it. They wanted him to sign it to begin with. It will inevitably be the Democrats winning here, but Baker is still putting up the fight.
And finally, we just have a minute or so left, but I kind of wanted to talk about the city of Boston, the mayoral race that will be shaping up because of the fact Boston Mayor Marty Walsh will be heading down to Washington to join the Biden administration. And this actually impacts Beacon Hill. Tell us how.
Yeah, this is something that will cross the legislature's desk, so to speak, as well as the governor's, in order to get rid of a special election that would be triggered when Walsh leaves, which the city council looks like they're going to vote for at this point. The legislature needs to sign off on that. So step one, the city of Boston says, we want to skip this special election. We want to have the acting mayor serve out the remainder of that term all the way until next year. And in place of that, we're just going to have the one election in September and then the general in November. But every lawmaker has to chime in on that first. It's one of those weird things about Massachusetts where changes like this have to happen at the state level, even though it's an issue for the city of Boston. So expect that vote to happen. It doesn't look like anyone in the state level is going to challenge this too much, but it could still have some road bumps ahead of it.
And that is CAI State House reporter Mike Dean. Mike, thanks as always. Have a great weekend.
Good to be with you.
And that was CAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean at the State House. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We just heard about the governor's veto of the climate bill. We're joined now by CAI environmental reporter Eve Zuckoff, whose beat is the human impacts of climate change. Eve, you spoke to some local environmentalists last night when this veto happened. Tell us, what was the response like locally to the veto of this climate change bill?
Yeah, in a word, it was disappointment. They told me, you know, every dollar we don't spend to solve the climate crisis now is going to cost us more in the future. And every day we go without a new comprehensive climate plan is really a scary day. You know, they said we don't have time for setbacks like this. So they also added that Baker, a couple of them said, you know, Baker has been sympathetic to a lot of climate issues, but this was a chance for Massachusetts to lead in the climate fight, and he chose not to. So they're feeling really disappointed in this decision, but also hopeful. You know, lawmakers are signaling that they're going to get this passed. They're already working on refiling the bill. So that's really what everyone, every environmentalist is watching now.
Eve, this week you also reported on a climate study that warns of a major new tipping point for the planet. Coming against this climate change bill, it seems even bigger. What does this new study say?
Yeah, so basically what this study does is it starts with the baseline fact that we assume, we know that plants absorb 25 to 30% of the carbon that we release into the atmosphere every year. But they look at, you know, how well will plants be able to absorb carbon as temperatures rise? And what they found is that after a certain tipping point that will probably be crossed in the next 20 years, plants in most ecosystems are less able to absorb carbon, while at the same time they release a lot of it through a process called cellular respiration. And, you know, as I said, if we continue emitting carbon at current rates, we will surpass this temperature threshold by 2040, they say, and plants' ability to absorb carbon will be reduced by 50%, which is a scary thing when every climate model relies on, plants and trees absorbing so much of our excess carbon.
With such a dire study like this, what are scientists recommending we do to avoid a tipping point?
Yeah, this is the same things that we say about climate change. We really have to reduce our carbon budget. We have to take a look, just as this bill that was sitting on Baker's desk, frankly, would have, at reducing emissions from the energy sector, from transportation, from housing. We have to reduce how much carbon we're releasing into the atmosphere.
CAI's environmental reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner. We spoke with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, CAI's Sam Houghton. We heard from Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette and CAI's Mike Dean at the State House and Eve Zuckoff there. Thanks to our Dan Treidel back at the studio. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.